Again, so I studied at this last meeting, and I guided through the through what we will talk about in the in this meeting. Last meeting, so we have pretty much covered all the most important aspects of being a scientist. Today, ethics. The first idea, and I definitely strongly encourage you to watch this short lecture. You probably know the website, TED, Technology, Education, Design. The talks there, the lectures are wonderful. Very well prepared, very well thought through. People are very impressive. So it is a good source of inspiration for how to deliver good talks. Definitely, if you have nothing to do, turn off your TV, which is source of typically of junk, and watch some good lectures on this website. Of course, there are different lectures. There are two types of lectures here, good and bad. Watch the good ones. This is one that I absolutely recommend. Phil Zimbardo is a psychologist who has done a lot of research on the what he calls psychology of evil, of the evil. And the talk is really very good. He gives a lot of examples and describes some of his experiments. He mentions in the lecture, you will hear it from him, there's a famous series of lectures by Stanley Milgram. Stanley Milgram was a Jewish kid. He actually, I think he knew him. They grew up somewhere in the Bronx, I think, or in Manhattan, somewhere there, he knew him. So it was right after the Second World War when people learned about what happened in Europe. The Germans, under the Nazi government, invaded many countries, and one of the important things they tried is to exterminate all the Jewish people in Europe. That was the goal. They didn't completely succeed, but they've done quite a lot. Second in line for the chimneys, as we can say ironically, were the Slavs, which includes Poles. So Jews were not the only ones and not the last ones. Gypsies, of course, and then other people who were handicapped. There were also some religions like Jehovah Witnesses, people who were homosexual. They all were targeted in the first place. And terrible things happened. Millions of people died. So the question that Milgram asked himself is, can something like this happen in the United States? And of course, first reaction is, no, that couldn't happen. Could something like that happen in Poland? No, of course not. Everybody's so good, you know. We have a normal society, normal situation. So how did Milgram, who was himself Jewish, go about it? He advertised in a newspaper for he needed subjects for his experiments. You know, subjects of the experiment, people who would be taking part in the experiment. He compensated them with some small amount of money, whatever. After the war, I think $10 would be plenty, a lot of money. Today it's probably equivalent, I don't know, 50, 100. This is a small compensation for a few hours of work. This is the setup. The setup is in the following. Here is the experimenter. So that's Milgram sitting there watching. And here is the subject. The subject has buttons saying you apply whatever, 15 volt to the learner. He explained it as you are the teacher, the subject, and here is the learner. The learner was actually an actor. The subject didn't know about it. So the learner knew what the subject pressed and was pretending that he was getting electric shock. The idea is that if you apply electric shock, then the learner will learn faster. Okay? So he was supposed to teach that learner something. And if the learner gave a wrong answer, he was to apply electricity to give the learner a shock. And the scale was 15 volts was the first one, and then it went up to 450 volts, I think. You can imagine what 450 volts applied for a second does to a human. And the actors were good, you know, they were pretending, oh, no, I cannot hold it. My heart is giving up. I have a heart problem, you know, complaining when things were happening. In that situation, the teacher, so the subject, somebody from the street, you know, a plumber from Fifth Avenue, and a teacher from Seventh Avenue, it's like people like you. They were not special selected, they were just people from the street. They were looking at the experimenter and asking, you know, should I go on with the electricity because he's having problems? And the experimenter said, yes, just go on. Who is going to be responsible? I'm going to be responsible. So now you see the setup. The question is, how high did the subject go with electricity? How high did they go? I forgot the exact numbers, but I think like 80% of the people went to 400 volts. Some of them refused at 300 or 200 or whatever. Some of them refused from the very beginning, but 80% of the people went that high. So here we are, you know, a German soldier asking, am I really to shoot those kids and the mother and the woman and she's pregnant, etc.? Yep. It's an order, ein Befehl, right? He does it. The same in US. So the question is, why did they do it? There's a population of sadists. I think there is a statistic. I forgot how many. 2% or 3% of the people have sadistic tendencies. So among us, maybe there are not enough of us, there may be at most one person who likes, you know, doing pain to the other person. But the rest of us are so-called normal people. We would never do that. So why would we, 80% of us, why would we go that high with electricity? Good question. Must be in us. These are some of the original pictures from Milgram experiments. You see, this is the actor applying electrodes. This is the place where you push the buttons. Looks very old-fashioned, but that was right after the Second World War. And that's the experimenter telling, I'm responsible, just go ahead, apply electricity. Of course, it wasn't real electricity, it was an actor, but the setup was quite realistic. Another experiment that Zimbardo talks about a lot, because it was his experiment, he conducted it. It was at Stanford, one of the top US universities, one of the top universities in the world. You've heard the name, probably. He conducted the following experiment. He has recruited volunteers among students, telling them that they are going to do some experiment. I forgot what he exactly said. It was a prison experiment anyway. He set up some of the rooms with bars and randomly assigned the roles. So suppose he recruited 30 students. He said randomly, using a coin, you are going to be a guard and you are going to be a prisoner. So pretty much, statistics stands behind us, they were the same people, really. People who were guards and prisoners. Within a few days, things were happening that happened, you may have heard a few years ago, actually quite a number of years ago, there were abuses of prisoners in Iraq by United States soldiers. In Abu Ghraib, they were doing all kinds of terrible things to prisoners. Things that you could that you can read about in German Nazi death camps or concentration camps. He had to interrupt the experiment because things were getting out of hand. They were doing all kinds of sadistic things to the prisoners, and they were the same type of people. So people who were just as good or just as bad as the prisoners were doing these things to the prisoners. Incredible. Zimbardo, the lecture is fascinating. 20 minutes, well invested. He's essentially telling, as a psychologist, that we humans are able to perform heroic deeds. Some people are heroes. They are doing things that are really heroic. And we are also capable of doing really evil acts. and it's in us. And we have to realize from the very, very beginning, from birth, parents should actually spend time on bringing up heroes, teaching the kids to be good, to be heroic. And for us, of course, who are already grown up, we need to realize that. It depends on the circumstances, which of the two can come to surface. He shows a few of these pictures. These are the drawings by Escher, a Swiss painter. If you look at the picture, you can see demons or angels, depending on what you concentrate on. The next experiment that is absolutely worth knowing, you know, psychology is a very kind of, they do a lot of things. Many experiments are just silly things that some of them confirm things that we know, some of them are more or less interesting. But there are several fundamental experiments in psychology. Zimbardo and Milgram are examples of really fundamental experiments that we should remember about. This is another one of these. This is a series of experiments by Solomon Asch. Solomon Asch has a relationship with Poland. He was born in Warsaw. I assume by his name he was Jewish, emigrated probably before the war, developed his scientific career in the United States, a psychologist. He was interested in the topic of group influence and of conformity. So how the opinion of individual people changes as pressures from the group are mounting. The experiment was as follows. Here are a couple of interesting things. An article in Wikipedia that you may want to look at, and also a short movie from the original experiments. You can see how it actually went. But here's the description. He had the following setup. He had actors and subjects. Actors were everybody in the room. Suppose you are all actors, except for you. And I tell you, well, come at 6 o'clock. The actors came at 5 to 6 at the latest. And you come at 6, since you are late, you know, oh, no problem, sit here, and so on. And before you came, I told everybody, when I ask you, one by one, which of the three lines, A, B, or C, is the same length as the one on the left, you have to say A, okay? You don't know about it. So you are the only subject who doesn't know about it. So I say, well, ladies and gentlemen, look, there are two sets of lines, A, B, C, and there is this one. Tell me which line, A, B, or C, the left line corresponds to. Which one?
A.
I'm not paying you.
And you now? You've seen that, yes. A fundamental thing. What turned out is that, I forgot the numbers again, but also on the order of like 80%, majority in that situation, his situation, would say A. And the reasons are different. Sometimes people doubt their own abilities. They think, well, you know, it looks like C, but who knows? Maybe I had a drink last night. I don't know for sure. Others think, well, I don't want to. They say in English, I don't want to rock the boat, right? Rocking the boat is no. So I don't want to rock the boat. I'll also say like the others do. Some people honestly start believing that it's A. Some people don't want to look different. In any case, many people are subject to that pressure from the group. Incredible experiment. There are other experiments that are showing the same thing, like I've seen a movie on the YouTube. You can search for it, Conformity. People in an elevator standing on all one, in one, looking at one direction, like that one. The person enters, looks around, you know, it's so strange, everybody's looking there. But after a moment, starts looking that way too, standing like that. Incredible. Why am I telling you that? I'm telling you that because we need to be aware, as educated people, especially educated, why educated? I'll mention later the noblesse oblige idea. But especially you, you have the duty to be absolutely independent and be aware of societies and group pressures. I can see group pressures incredibly in many instances. Let's say, looking at politics is my favorite thing because it's, you know, a lot of things are happening that you can read about in psychology papers and books, but you can see that right there in front of you. For example, Polish society may be the only one in Europe where majority of people thinks that the Smolensk disaster was an accident. Amazingly, Polish, why is that? Why is that in Poland and not in the other countries in Europe? What is it? You can look at the analysis of that and the reasons, you know, the media influence, all kinds of, you know, pressure from our enemies, Russia. But it's a surprising thing. If you don't believe me, read about this. You will see that that is happening. Why on earth, us who have such experiences with Russia, why on earth in this society is such a large number of believers? I would call them believers. They use the term Smolensk sect. I believe that it's an interesting expression, but I think it's probably more appropriate to be labeled to people who are actually believing that the official Russian report and the two reports that were done in Poland, Miller and who's the other guy? I forgot. Not worth remembering anyway. So be aware of that. One thing I noticed when I left Poland in 1981, and most of you probably were not alive yet, I grew up in the communist system, and I was absolutely, I had all the tools to be resistant to the propaganda. I grew up in a Catholic family, patriotic. I was very close. I was an altar boy. Many people I knew were very highly skeptical of what was happening at the time in Poland. Still, when I moved out of Poland and to the Netherlands, it took me months to realize how much of that propaganda has sticked to my mind. In simple things, amazing. Even though I was resisting, I didn't want it, etc., etc. So ask yourself the question, in many situations, many respects, not only in real life, where, by the way, you are still professors, doctors, and people are looking at you, but look at also in science. In science, the same things will be happening. Everybody says certain things, and you start believing that this is the way things are. So a scientist should absolutely be trying to be independent. When you hear something and you start having doubts, is this true? Keep questioning. Why? Among my mentors that I showed you weeks ago and a couple of months ago, especially Adolf Grunbaum, the philosopher, I probably was inquisitive, but his influence was amazing because I really started to ask sometimes very kind of simple questions, questioning things when people say something. And it is amazing how far you can get actually by just questioning, politely questioning things. I would call him in Polish, his attitude, upierdliwy. Sometimes we are a little angry at people who are like that, but when we are trying to get to the truth, it's absolutely the right attitude. Of course, with all the politeness, being nice, etc. Absolutely. So just be aware of that, what is happening. People essentially suppress their own sound judgment because, well, maybe the others are right, the people around me. Another experiment that I should that is absolutely worth remembering and mentioning in the context of ethics is the Good Samaritan experiment. I suspect most of you know the story of the Good Samaritan from the Bible, from the New Testament. Anybody who doesn't know that? Well, quick thing. A guy was attacked by bandits, wounded, dying, and robbed of his belongings, and left on the side of the road. And there were several people passing. They looked at him and went on. And there was a priest, there was a scholar, etc. Everybody passed. But then there was a Samaritan. Samaritans were looked down upon by the Jews at that time. They lived in the north of Israel, and they had some schism that the Jews didn't think much of them. So a Samaritan, like, you know, a lower type of lower class person, goes there, looks at the guy, stops, dresses his wounds, brings him to an inn, asks, he says, "I have to go on business to that town, but please take care of this guy. Here is the money for you. When I get back, whatever you spend more, I will reimburse you." So he essentially takes care of that wounded unlucky person. A Good Samaritan story. So now the experiment. It was conducted in a seminary, so a school, university for priests. Priests, you could expect them to be, to have a calling, people who are maybe, their average, I would expect, is a little higher in terms of ethics and good behavior, right? You could expect that reasonably. There may be many reasons why people want to become priests, but I would expect that the average should be higher. So now that these clerics, I think they are called clerics, they are seminarians. They were part of an experiment, but they didn't know it, of course, about it. Essentially, randomly assigned to two groups, actually four groups, I think. There were four groups, two factors. One is the time left, and the other one is the type of lecture or sermon they are supposed to deliver. So the first dimension, the sermon. One group got were to tell the story of the Good Samaritan in a sermon, exercise their preaching skills. The other group were telling was told, "Well, you have to go to this building C and then deliver a lecture on earning opportunities in the seminary. You can make some money on the side for your pocket money." So an important job opportunities in a seminary, and boring, essentially, a lecture. And the other one, Good Samaritan. The other dimension was time. They were telling, "Well, you'd better hurry, because the lecture starts in 5 minutes. The other group was told, "Oh, you know, it starts in 15 minutes or so, so you have to get there." So we are in wing C, it's like wing A, over there where you enter the building. And on the way, so in this thin passage between the buildings, there was an actor on the ground holding his chest or his belly, saying, "Oh, you know, oh, something is happening." You could suspect maybe heart attack or something bad happening. And now they were looking at how many of the seminarians will stop to help the guy. So we have exactly the story of the Good Samaritan. Yes, that's what we have. And what happened? Again, I don't know the numbers, I don't remember the numbers, but majority of the clerics just went past, just looked at them and he went past, because they were in a hurry. So independent on the lecture or sermon that they had to deliver, they just passed through. Very few of them stopped. The second dimension, the time, that was more critical. When they had 5 minutes, they were more likely to go. When they had 15 minutes, they were more likely to stop and help the person. So, again, think about this. We talked about time management. Of course, you have to be efficient. You have to use your time. You have to build your career, etc. But remember, don't forget about really important things. We are all humans, and we should all try to be good Samaritans. Whether we are Christians or not, it doesn't matter. It's a good story touching the foundations of ethical behavior in society. Good experiment, really, especially given that it was conducted in the seminary, where people should be very aware of that story and what should happen. This is the first two are from Zimbardo's lecture. When you watch it, you hear it, that it's a good idea to nurture a hero in yourself. Just, you know, prepare yourself for the moment where you will be facing a situation where you need to make a decision. You are either a hero, you say, for example, no, or you are a demon, and you say, well, okay, fine, you know, you let the evil happen around you. When you are a parent, nurture that in your children. This raise them as future heroes rather than future demons, because you know what demons can do in the world. A very robust finding, very interesting finding, is that in the Milgram's experiments, the first 15 volts were crucial. People who agreed to apply electricity at 15 volts were more likely to go all the way to 450. People who refused, many of them refused to apply 15 volts already. So it's an interesting thing, you know, that when you commit the first sin, you are losing your virginity, as one could say. The third point, beware of the first sin, that was something I heard from a priest when I was doing confession as a young man. You know, I remember it definitely. He was just telling me about some sin that I was committing, you know, over and over. I told the priest, I have problems with that. He said, you know, beware of the first sin. So, when you get out of the church, make sure that you don't do it for the first time. Because when you do it for the first time, you'll do it, you know, until the next confession again. There is something like a concept of virginity. You know, we change our opinion, approach to things the first time we do something. When we are facing a decision, that first decision is crucial because that leads us in a certain path, one or another. There's a movie I will recommend you later on. There is a scene that is beautifully demonstrating it. You see that slide on that movie. It's A Man for All Seasons. The Polish title is Oto jest głowa zdrajcy. That's a movie about St. Thomas More and the time around his death. He was ordered killed by Henry VIII, the one who had six wives. I'll tell you more about the story. But in any case, Oliver Cromwell, who has the task of being this prosecutor, like, you know, in Stalin times or Hitler times, prosecuting according, following the law, is actually, you know, killing the innocent man. He's trying to convince somebody to spy on him. And the guy is young, inexperienced, but he is really very eager to develop his career as in the government. He is very resistant. No, I'm not going to tell anything on him because he is such a good, such a great person. And Cromwell somehow leads him to this first step and then even says, it was easy, wasn't it? You know, the first step. He ends up to be the main person who actually leads to the conviction because he, during the process, during the court case, he gives a false testimony. So beware of that first sin. I really compare it to virginity. You know, you are in a way a virgin in respect to doing something bad, but when you do it for the first time, second time is much easier. So definitely beware of that you know, small step that you may be tempted to do. The second, so this was the first idea, kind of telling us that it's all in us. We all like to think about ourselves as good people, but remember there is also this this evil lurking under, and that evil can actually make us do demonic things. The second middle part is the different opportunities of for ethical or unethical behavior in science. So the fundamental question is that with some sort of phrase is that with any knowledge we don't know how it is going to be used. So invention of fire, well, discovery how to make fire, actually not invention, or invention how to make fire. You know, you can make food, you can boil food, but you can also, and you can feel warmer, but you can also burn somebody else's house, right? That's arson, that's a bad thing. With a knife, you know, you can use knife to cut bread to share it with other people, but you can also use a knife to kill somebody. Yes. With everything that we do, we don't really know the use, and everything can be used potentially in a bad way. Think about atomic energy. You can use it for generation of electricity, good for the humanity, but you can also use it to kill many people at the same time. Good and bad applications. So you have, as a scientist, we have the obligation to participate in the discussion of how the inventions and discoveries are going to be used. It's an obligation. Albert Einstein, who felt responsible for his theoretical work on atomic energy, created an organization called PUGWASH, P-U-G, WASH, PUGWASH. I don't know where the name comes from. The only thing I know is that the organization focuses on consequences of discoveries. So the ethical side of science. I never participated in it, but I know of that organization, and I think in a way we should all feel like people who could do things like that. And in any discipline, there are things that could be used for bad things. You probably know it. If you're a psychologist like Zimbardo, oh, wow, I can do that? Wow. You know, you can actually use it in a bad way or a good way. The same when you are engineers to develop something, people can use it for weapons or other things. So we have to be aware of that and participate in the societal discussion. Of course, there are limits to curiosity. Curiosity, of course, drives science. We are curious about things that may happen when we do things. But it's not a sufficient justification for scientific research. And there are many examples of abuse of science. I may have mentioned the things that were happening in the German concentration camps, experiments with people, killing them in the name of science, things that were really terrible, experiments with twins, infecting people on purpose, freezing them just to see whether we can discover any way of reviving them. Important in military applications, when a pilot is shot down on the English Channel, they wanted to, when they rescue the pilot, maybe to resuscitate, revive the pilot. So they were conducting experiments like that. Experiments with cervical cancer, with women, all kinds of bad experiments. But there were also things done, actually, after the Second World War that are that have led to existence of committees that are giving you permission for experiments. Whenever you, as scientists, want to do any experiments with animals or people, you will need to ask permission of a committee present in every university these days that analyzes what will happen, whether there's going to be any harm to people in the experiment. I don't think it would be easy to get permission for Milgram's experiments today. I think we are aware of the consequences, and these are quite risky experiments. After the Second World War, there was a famous experiment in the United States that led to that subject clearance committees. In the military, somewhere in the Midwest, it's known as Tuskegee syphilis experiment. What they did is they decided not to treat soldiers, and they were black soldiers, black Americans, who had syphilis. They decided not to treat them in order to observe what will happen, observe the later stages of the disease. When that came out, of course, it was a big scandal, and it led to the development of those subject clearance committees. So it's not only Nazis, not only communists that were doing these kind of things. Ordinary, good people were also involved in things that we would think of as terribly evil. In any case, curiosity has limits, and today, if you want to do something with people, with animals, you will need other people to look at it beforehand to give you permission. And I think that's good. That's an extra step, costs you time, costs you headache. You need to apply maybe 4 weeks in advance, but I think it's a good idea. That's a nice joke. My friends, as a result of our experimentation, we have just lost a dear and valued colleague. On the other hand, we have just gained a publication. That's an example of curiosity. Conflict of interest. That's an important thing. You can get money from many places for research. And I mentioned to you maybe earlier that there are many funding organizations. In the United States, you can get money from the government, National Science Foundation, like in Poland, Fundacja Nauki Polskiej. Then in US, there are military organizations. They are there in Poland too. You can get money from NATO, but maybe also even Polish military, although not as much money as in US. And then there are also foundations that can give you money for research related to their main purpose. But there is also money from companies. You can get money from a company to do research. And here you have to watch out, because I would generally advise you against accepting money from a company like Philip Morris. Philip Morris, my wife didn't know what company it is, interestingly. What is Philip Morris doing?
Tobacco.
Cigarettes. Well, you can accept money to do research that is unrelated to tobacco, but if you get money on research on the good or bad things, consequences of smoking tobacco, chewing tobacco, it's dirty money. Why is it dirty money? Well, if the result of your research is tobacco is excellent for your health, of course, Philip Morris is going to be happy, but nobody is going to believe you. Because you have to, in publications, you are obliged to report the sources of funding. If you are funded by Philip Morris, forget about people believing you in the results. If your result is tobacco is very bad, people are still going to be suspicious of you, but this is probably going to be the last grant from Philip Morris, and they are not going to be unhappy. So, in general, watch out where you get the money from. If you are pacifist, if you don't like wars, if you don't like military at all, I would probably think it's not ethical for you to accept money from the military. Once I got money from NATO, and I remember one of my colleagues in Spain, because we got a group of from several countries, one of my colleagues said he wanted to, in our publication, to put, we thank NATO for the grant number this and this, but we are generally against military funding for civilian, for research or something. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. If he wants, I said, well, we can write, we get money from a NATO grant number, but the second author, or Dr. Diaz, is against, he didn't want that, so we didn't put it. In any case, it's a tricky thing. You realize that you have to watch out where you get the money from. This is, of course, a joke. I don't think NIH, National Institute of Health, puts their nose into your work. I think they are quite independent, just like National Science Foundation. They are a decent organization, so I don't think this is in any way dirty money. It's a joke. You are completely free to carry out whatever research you want, as long as you come to these conclusions. That happens very rarely. You know, people very rarely tell you to do bad things. There is this cult movie, especially for men. Men like watching it. Godfather. It's about mafia. You know, the mafioso, they don't say like, you have to kill that guy. They don't say that. They say, well, this guy is a pain in the back. I don't want to see him anymore. And you kind of, you kill him, and you say, you won't see him anymore. Right, with this Brooklyn Italian accent. Very rarely things like that are happening that openly. Also with corruption, with influence in politics. I don't think that Mrs. Van der Leyen is coming to Prime Minister Tusk and saying, well, I'll help you with winning the elections, but you have to stop Central Port. I don't think she's doing that. She says essentially, you know, Donald, I think that port, Central Port, I don't think it's a very good idea for Poland, you know. And he kind of gets the message, you know. This is the way things are happening. And the same also in with all kinds of influences. Just watch out for that. Preserve this independent, common sense. Don't lose it ever. Because pressure very rarely comes so clearly. The devil very rarely comes to you with the horns and the tail and, black clothing. That's just a fairy tale type of presenting of the evil, of the devil. So just watch out. I can prove it or disprove it. What do you want me to do? You are, as a scientist, in the business of serving the humankind, and humankind is your ultimate employer, and you are responsible to humanity. So remember about that. You are not serving any prime minister for education, or rector, or dean, or whatever, or your colleagues. You have to be independent, and that's what your task is as a scientist. We have many opportunities for unethical behavior. We can steal inventions or ideas. That's the main good that we can steal as scientists, I guess. Because what else can we steal? A pencil? It's fine, right? We don't do that. So ideas and inventions. Why can we steal it? Why do we want to steal it? Well, because we get the benefit, right? We get a publication, then we get more money because we are famous. So there are temptations. And there are many, many borderline situations. You know, you get a paper to review, you read it, and say, wow, what a nice idea, right? I'm going to use it. That's, of course, unethical. As a reviewer, you are supposed to forget about things that you read in other people's papers. And that's, of course, a difficult thing. And some people are like that. People are very different, of course. I know in my field a guy who, when he reads a paper like that, what a good idea. Well, I'm sure it's mine. Or I'm sure I could have come up with that idea myself. So he essentially assimilates those ideas. It happened a couple of times. And, through the grapevine, I was warned against him. I had once an encounter with ethics like that. We had a paper with my doctoral student. We sent it to a conference, and then, or to a journal, and the journal was, let me think, because it was 20 years ago or so. I had an email from a doctoral student from another university, good university, with a good advisor, asking, I was asked for by my advisor to review that paper. I found it excellent, so the recommendations to publish. But I like the idea of that heuristic. Can I quote it, or can I use it, or whatever? He asked something like that. So he essentially revealed who he is, which he shouldn't be doing. And then my student, a couple of months later, finds a submission to a conference that we were supposed to review that essentially uses one of our ideas, one of the heuristics. So I immediately, sent an email, quite a short email, but also quite forceful, saying, well, you used that heuristic that you saw in our paper, please explain. Sometimes, you have to be short. That is more forceful. Well, in his explanations, I came up with that heuristic independently. Okay, that's possible. We have no way of checking. But things don't look good for him, because he came up with it independently. He didn't tell us at the time of reviewing our paper, hey, I love your paper, but I came up with that heuristic independently. So things didn't look good. I was still a young scientist. I was 5 years after my doctorate, not very long, I felt insecure. What do you do in that situation? Well, you ask more experienced people. So I asked one of my colleagues in the department, what do I do with that? And she said to me,
you have to force them to do something, and you have to be the one writing what they should write. So I essentially told him, wrote a little longer email saying, well, things don't look good for you. It is possible that you discovered it independently. Why didn't you tell us? Etc., etc. But I want you to put in the acknowledgments of your paper, because I cannot prove that he didn't come up with it independently. I want you to put the following sentence. This idea, the author had access to an early draft that had that idea. I was the one who composed that piece. And in our paper, we added the following sentence. This heuristic was apparently, discovered by somebody, by this and this person, who had access to an early draft of our paper. Something like that, which, again, puts things in the right order. So
you have to be careful. Things like that happen. Very often you will not discover them, but if you do discover them, you can also react to them.
As a reviewer, remember, your obligation is to forget what you read. That's your obligation. Of course, we are humans. Very rarely we will forget, right? You have early access to that information. When they publish, of course, you can use it wherever you want, acknowledging them. Without acknowledgement, you cannot do that. Rules for paper authorship. We talked about this a little, I think. It's important to be the first author when you have more than two. When you have three or more authors, the first author gets the most credit because it's Jones et al. And others, right? You don't say Jones, Smith and Brown, you say Jones et al. So that name has a bigger exposure. It's read by more people. In some disciplines, but not in engineering, people want to be the last. The last person is usually traditionally the head of the laboratory, the big guy, the big person, who's the name last. When you are with two, it's less important to be first, but also people assume usually the first author is the one who did whose idea it was. When you discuss who should be the first, I think that definitely the person who had the idea, the most important idea from the paper, is the first. So when you work with your advisor, and your advisor says, John, why don't you work this out? It's quite normal, quite natural that that your advisor is going to be the first author, even if you do most of the work, right? So don't feel very bad about this. What do you do with it? Well, have ideas, right? Come up with ideas as you go. Adding people who have not contributed to the paper is unethical. So I've heard situations like an advisor or a faculty member said, why don't you add this person to the author list? If you've never met that person, you don't know what that person has done, you should ask questions. Who is this? What did the person do? Of course, just like in mafia conversations, in big politics, as I said, the advisor will tell you, well, you know, I discussed with him some of the ideas he or she contributed, right? You have to be insistent. What exactly did she contribute or he contribute, right? It's okay, really, to be insistent. Why? So that the advisor, your co-author, never again does this to you, right? Sometimes you have to show your nails and your teeth. There is a saying in Polish, na pochyłe drzewo nawet koza wskoczy. You occasionally have to show your strength. Like, you know, a tiger will show the nails and the teeth. If you don't do that, people will walk over you, whether it's in business, in science, or in personal life. When you are we talked about this, when you are in a relationship, husband-wife, you have to watch out the first time something happens that you don't like, point it out. Solve the problems early. The reason why you should be insistent and keep asking questions, who is that, why, etc., is that person never again does this to you. Your goal is maybe not getting that person out of the author's list, because it's difficult, it's tricky, because your advisor, whoever it is, can say, well, you know, I discussed with that person, she contributed, I think she should be the author also. You have no way of proving that it didn't happen. But you can at least prepare the grounds for that person never doing it again to you, right? You have to be questioning, because it's unethical on you, on your part, to add somebody to the author's list if that person has done nothing. A person deserves to be on the author's list when the paper would not have been written without that person. I mean, written, it would not come to being without that person. That's a good criterion for authorship. A person who is cleaning the dishes in the lab, who is programming your programs, does not automatically deserve being an author, a co-author. Remember that. It's a person who has made intellectual contributions, did writing, did discussions about the ideas, came up with the idea. These are the authors. So here you can also have unethical behavior. Some journals, very respectable journals, ask you to, at the end of the paper, to write what each of the authors did. That's a good way of And if you notice that they are lying there, adding somebody and then put a lie, say, did that person really write that? I don't remember, right? And again, it's showing the teeth so that doesn't happen again, most of all. But if things are clear, of course, fight also not to have that person on the authorship list. With first, second author, you know, sometimes it's tricky, of course. This is real life. You don't... it's like with a divorce. When you are divorcing, I hope none of you will go through that, and you have children, you are starting to quarrel with your husband and wife. Of course, the tendency is the good things in my child are from my side of the family. The bad things, his or her, right? That's a natural tendency. You see that in these kind of situations. Now think about writing a paper, an idea, as having a child. It's very difficult to say whose child it is, because you've been meeting every week, talking for an hour. At the end, you may think, well, most of the work I did, right? But the other person can think the same thing. I've seen that situation. It was kind of funny. One of my doctoral students, we had a good series of papers, really good. They got noticed. And I kind of jokingly, well, not joking, I really thought it was my idea. And I told him, well, it was a good idea I had then. Yes, wasn't it? I forgot what I exactly said. Because in any case, I said it was my idea. He looked at me and said, no, it was my idea. And I don't know whose idea it was, really. I don't know. I'm not bold enough to say, no, it was mine. Because we were meeting, talking about it. Maybe it was his idea. Very, very likely. It's very hard to say that. So what do you do when you want to be on the first place in the paper? There are good and bad things about different things that you can do. If you start quarreling, it was mine, what will happen is you will destroy somewhat the relationship with your co-author, whoever it is, because they will think, well, you are unreasonable, right? On the other hand, if you don't come up for yourself, then they will be walking over you, right? So you have to do something. What I would advise, typically, is to develop some kind of compromise, saying, okay, it's okay, you are going to be the first author on this paper, but the next paper that we are working on, can I be the first author? Yeah, it's a good compromise. Okay. Sometimes it's hard to say who made bigger contribution, like in a child. Sometimes you see clearly the genes of the father, sometimes clearly the genes of the mother, right? But it's very hard to say, really, because they are sharing the genes of both. Conflict of interest, you have to be careful about this incredibly. My feeling is that people don't really fully feel or understand it yet. I'm talking about Poland, or they're pretending they don't understand it. You see it in, there was a funny, there was a minister of sports in early 2010s. She was the minister of sport. Her name is
some kind of insect. Muha, isn't she in the government now? I don't know. Anyway, she employed her personal hairdresser as one of the directors in her department. There were jokes made in the radio that we are going to have a new sports discipline, hair cutting. You know, the fact that she did not say, "Well, I'm so sorry to the people who elected her, and I'm going to resign, or I put myself to the at the disposition of the prime minister," that beats me. You know, and there was once at our university a case where there was some kind of money, and the deans of the departments were proposing people to get that money, and the deans were also sitting in a committee that actually assigned that money. And I pointed out to one of the officials, "Isn't this a conflict of interest?" And that official responded to me, "No, it's not a conflict of interest, because there is Mr. Rector is going to be present in the meetings, and he will take care of the fact that there is no conflict of interest." That's, of course, a ridiculous idea, right? Conflict of interest is precisely when you are representing two different things. You know, you're representing the university, and at the same time, you're representing another company or something. Right? That's a conflict of interest. So watch out for that whenever you are involved in any kind of, I don't know, reviewing. Conflict of interest is when you are working for Philip Morris and you are publishing a paper that tells how good cigarette smoke is for our health. That's an evident conflict of interest. But many journals require you to report any conflict of interest. Conflict of interest is, my wife was telling me, when she was working on the cervical cancer, very often doctors and scientists were paid by drug companies to go to first-class airplane ticket, to go to a conference, 5 or 7-star hotels, I don't know if there are hotels like that, but anyway, many stars hotels and food in order to go to a conference, in which, of course, silently they were expected to say that the HPV vaccine by whatever, Merck, is the best one there is, right? You have to be aware of that, and just try not to accept any money that is trying to influence you. It's kind of funny how often in politics that happens, how often the new Ustava Viatrakova in January, remember that? The government has just entered the thing. They are presenting proposal for a new law that is pretty much written by companies that are building windmill plants. It's ridiculous, of course. The fact that they didn't all resign, the politicians who brought it, is, you beat me, why they didn't have the honor to, enough honor to actually say we are resigning. Protect intellectual property of the authors from others, but also from yourself. That's the hardest, of course, when you do peer review. The next idea, I think this is pretty much almost the last one, two ideas that I wanted to present. So, you know, I leave you with having to recognize ethical issues on your own, pretty much. I tell you only where they can happen, but you have to. Nobody will do it for you. You have to do it yourself. So I'm just telling. I told you about the duality of human character, the evil and angel in us. But then the second idea that I think is very, very important, and again I see so many times that idea violated in my favorite field, politics, that it's amazing. And I've seen it also, unfortunately, done among scientists. That. Privilege always carries responsibility. When you are the president of Poland or the prime minister of Poland, it's not just that you have a nice office, a palace, a nice chair where you can sit and say this, that, people will do that for you, because that's the privilege side. Actually, it's an incredible duty. In fact, the word minister is, I think, derives from the word servant, serving the people.
people often, politicians, forget about the duty and remember about the privileges, the expensive dinners in restaurants with octopuses, etc. But that's part of it. I'm not envying them at all. I can also cook an octopus myself, and I can afford to buy it also too. But there is an incredible duty that comes with the privilege. Now, the duty that I want to mention here is the duty that comes with your education. So you are already educated people. Very soon, hopefully, I'll keep my fingers crossed for all of you, you will be doctors in a few years from now. And that's an incredible privilege. You are going to put in front of your name doctor, Dr. Kowalski, Kowalska. That's almost like a Nobel title in the past, right? You will be doctor. That puts you on the spot, you know. People will look at you. When you live in a village, I live in a village, small village. I never tell who I work for. Not in my village, I didn't do that yet, but when I like fishing, I told you that. Sometimes I have fishing buddies who are, you know, simple people. So when I go fishing, I fish the ice fishing in Siemianówka. The news spread very quickly from my colleague that I'm a professor. So when somebody comes to me and says, "You're a professor?" No, I clean at the technical university. In any case, the important thing is that you will be at the, people will look up to you. I live in a small village. I bet there are, the grape wine has already spread that my wife and I are professors. So now imagine me going through the middle of the village and picking my nose. Oh boy, that's an incredible thing. People will think, what kind of professors are they in Technical University of Białystok, right? What kind of class of people it is? Imagine being a judge or a prosecutor who is stealing money, and things like that happen. Imagine being a judge who is fighting for the independence of judges, who is killing a motorcyclist. That happened just a few months ago. Imagine being an important politician, celebrity, who is driving drunk and almost killing a motorcyclist. That happened also. Imagine a priest who is a pedophile. Things like that happen too. Right? All of those cases are incredible. I hope there is a special, in hell, there is a special place for this kind of people, because the damage they are doing to the society is just incredible. This is the idea that was brought up by, I kind of remembered it from my high school, Andrzej Fritsch Modrzewski, that's 16th century, not 17th, who wrote a piece that pretty much kind of brings it forward. On the penalty for manslaughter, łaści albo karze za mężobójstwo. He wrote there that the legal system in Poland at that time is unjust. Because when you are a nobleman, noble person, and you are killing a peasant, then you get just, financial penalty, whatever. It was 10 grzywna, right? That's whatever it is, that measure of money, that's it. But when you are a peasant and you are killing a nobleman, you get, when you are a nobleman killing a nobleman, you get 120. And that, he said, that's completely unjust. People who are at a higher position, they are setting a much worse example than uneducated peasants. So when you see an uneducated peasant picking his nose or her nose, okay, he doesn't know better, right? She doesn't know better. But a professor doing this? Professor stealing, lying, behaving impolitely, fighting for things? We shouldn't be doing this, because the damage we are doing is really very large. So something very, very important to realize, and that is the duty. A politician being accepting bribes, well, that's terrible, because The politician has the trust of all their voters, of all of us. But whether we voted for him or not, we accept that the majority of our neighbors were voting for that person. But if that person is stealing or being corrupt, yeah, that's terrible. They should probably burn out of shame. Samozaplon. And if not, then they should be let out to punished. So duty and privilege, privilege and duty. I told you about that movie, A Man for All Seasons. That's an interesting movie. The A Man for All Seasons is an idiom in English. It means that a person for good and bad times, na dobre I na złe. So if you have a good friend, whether it's a difficult situation or a good situation, he will be always your friend. Right? He will always be standing next to you. Your husband, your wife, your friend. A Man for All Seasons. Very impressive fellow, Thomas More. He became a saint later in the Catholic Church, and John Paul II declared him to be the patron of politicians. If you ever consider becoming a politician, or if you are considering to become a person who is, you know, educated or higher, you should watch that movie. It's very well made. 1966. Don't expect special effects, digital effects, fighting. There's none of it. There are just costumes, maybe some old boats, castle, palace, interiors. But the nicest thing in that movie is the dialogues. The dialogues are just phenomenal. What is the story? The story is the political pressure. Henry VIII had a wife. At some point, he got bored of her, whatever the reason. He didn't like her. So what did he do? He wanted the marriage to be annulled. As you know, there are no divorces in Catholic Church. So he wanted the Pope to declare that this marriage was invalid to start with, so that he can find another wife. So the Pope, I guess, found a good case. He annulled that marriage. So he married again. And then he said, no, I don't like this wife either. I want the first annulment to be annulled or something. He wanted the Pope to do something that was ridiculous, really ridiculous. And the Pope said, no, I'm not going to do that. So Henry VIII said, well, in that case, I don't want to be part of that ridiculous church. I'm going to create my own church, the Church of England. I'm going to be the head of that church. Nobody will tell me what to do with my wives. Right? And that's essentially the foundation of the Church of England. I asked once a priest, we had a neighbor, a priest of the Church of England, a female priest, she was one of the first batches of female priests, about those foundations and what does she think about it. No, she said, well, we all in the Church of England have a problem with that. But anyway, that is the foundation of the church. So now, in the middle of that, the first, second wife, you know, the third wife, etc., and the splitting from the Catholic Church, he wanted, of course, like every dictator, he wanted people to acknowledge that he is the head of the church, and people acknowledge his new marriage, etc. And there was some resistance that was met with force. A prominent person resisting that was Thomas More. He did the following thinking: my life is very dear to me, and it was given to me by God. I cannot just dispose of my life lightheartedly. So he said, I have to defend. How will I defend? Well, I defend to the best of my ability. I'm a lawyer. He was a lawyer. So he thought he's going to keep quiet, not say anything, right, about that marriage and the splitting from the church. And the pressure. Why the pressure? Because he was a prominent person. He was a famous person for being honest, not accepting bribes, and just a very impressive person that was befriended to the king, Henry VIII. He even wrote a book for the king. So they really wanted to spoil him. And that is the mechanism that you will find in people. Very much so. If somebody is really spoiled to their core, that person will try to make the other people also spoiled, or in any case, he will feel better. That's a very human character feature. There's another movie and book that I recommend, actually book, you will not see it in the movie. Milan Kundera, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. Of course, in Polish you can find it. It's not a very good book. Communist Times, 1968, Czechoslovakia. People who, you know, there's the Soviets come in, they overturn the government, and they want to everybody to sign that they are loyal to the new government. And Dr. Tomasz, I think, he was never interested in politics, but he found it ridiculous, and he said, I'm not going to sign it. And then it was interesting that he describes it, the author describes the feelings of the other people. The other people were kind of, you know, internally, people who signed the loyalty thing, they were trying to kind of joy, feeling the joy inside from the fact that he is going to sign that too, right? It's something very, very human. You kind of want the, if you are spoiled, you want to have this argument that other people are spoiled too. Everybody does this, right? So, and that was the pressure that he was facing. So they really did anything they could to make him sign or to get rid of him. And ultimately they kill him, of course. They really were determined to kill him. They killed him. But the movie shows you this development of the character and his defense. If they did not have somebody who was giving a false witness, they would have never gotten to him because he knew the law very well. When they were threatening him, Cromwell was threatening him. He says, well, you are threatening me like a butcher. Cromwell asks, how should I threaten you? Like a statesman, using the law. Right. Wonderful this, conversations. One conversation with his good friend, Duke of Norfolk, who says, well, why don't you sign it? Look, everybody signed it. Every of our friends signed that thing. And he says, well, when you die and we face God, you go to heaven for doing the, your conscience because the conscience allows you to sign it. And I'm going to hell because I didn't do what my conscience was telling. Will you come with me for fellowship to hell? Beautiful conversation, kind of against that idea. Everybody does it. Not a good explanation. Everybody does it. You are responsible for yourself. This is a wonderful joke. I love it. I sometimes use that expression. We have to do everything ethically from now on, within the bounds of reason, of course. So, you know, some people are ethical within the bounds of reason. When things are convenient, well, they will sacrifice some of the ethics. There are no pressures in the world without political, there are no environments without political pressures. If you think that communism or Nazism were the places where there were pressures, but there are no pressures in today's Poland, today's United States, or today's Germany or Netherlands or whatever, you are wrong. Every environment has pressures, political pressures, and they have the tendency to become bigger. Here's a nice joke, an American joke. All the other women in the office are suing you for sexual harassment. Since you haven't sexually harassed me, I'm suing you for discrimination. In Poland, we are facing now a change in the law, European law, that will penalize us for so-called hate speech. Hate speech is completely fuzzy, undefined term. What is hate speech? You can trust me that people who will define what hate speech is are the people you would want to define the term the last. This is a smart, sleazy way of introducing censorship in our country, in our lives. Trust me, we can talk about it in a year or two from now when this was introduced. Pressures like that, like the ones in the joke, are absolutely there in the United States. You have to face them. There are now, and there will be more pressures. So, how do you cope with those pressures? Thomas More is absolutely impressive, you know. Refused to say anything. There's an old Roman maxim, which I suppose in the movie, silence means approval. He was using that. So he said, well, if I don't say anything, you have to assume that I approve it. That was not enough for them.
Of course. So you will find yourself under pressure, political or other pressures, perhaps sometimes strong enough that will make it hard for you to be ethical, and it's your duty to be ethical. So where do you take this inspiration from? There are many sources of inspiration around you that you can use. I mentioned to you Thomas More. This link shows you a scene. There are a few pieces of that movie in the YouTube. Who knows, maybe there's an illegal, well, actually legal, because it's 50 years already since publishing the movie, so maybe it's just public domain now. You can find it somewhere. You can find it definitely in Polish places. A beautiful scene where Richard Rich, that young man who bore the false witness against him, he asks to see his new sign of dignity. What is it? It's the Attorney of Wales, a very big thing in the government. It's like the Governor of Wales. And he says to him, "What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul?" That's a quote from New Testament. But he says, "But for Wales? You did it for Wales only?" Here are a couple of my personal, well, this is of course also my discovery, incredible thing. I had a librarian in my high school in Dublin who was, she was incredible, very quiet, very modest, just a woman. She was not allowed to be a teacher. We cannot allow such people to teach our youth, of course, in communist times. So she was a librarian, but she did a lot of good work as a librarian. I learned from her, indirectly, very, very carefully, very gently about cutting the details, because she had somewhere in the library the old Nazi German newspapers from the Second World War that were telling about the discovery of cutting graves. I learned from her about the value of good quality work. She was essentially very critical about one of my colleagues who was helping with the library, a lot of good things. I learned later that she was also very supportive to the teachers. My Polish teacher that I mentioned, even last week, she told her, "Well, don't worry, it will be over one day, the communism, of course, it's over." Gandhi is an incredible inspiration to all of us. He was not Christian, he was a Hindu, very religious Hindu, but from the point of Christianity, he was very close to perfection. Close to being a saint. He understood Christianity very, very well. In fact, he used it to get rid of the British in India. And there is a wonderful, there's this movie, Gandhi. You can find pieces of it also on YouTube. Here's a nice piece. I wrote the exact minutes where you can find it. I don't think we will have time to watch it together. Where he says there is a young lawyer who comes from India to South Africa, where he was first working, Gandhi, and he said, "Well, maybe you are surprised that I'm coming here to help you. And he said, "No, I'm not surprised, because when you are fighting for a just cause, when you're doing something right, people will pop out of the pavement to help you. That's true. If you are fighting for a just cause, you don't need to say the words. People will quietly also aid you. That is also a property of people. That's the good in us. That we recognize other people suffering, other people who are done wrong, and we help them." Many inspiring things about Gandhi. This is one of them that I selected. Another thing this was my first visit to Białystok. Professor Bobrowski, my colleague here, invited me to visit. And I was terribly jet-lagged because of the time difference. It was the summer, May or June. The light, as you know, 4 o'clock, I couldn't sleep. So I woke up and turned on the TV, and there was a late movie in the middle of the night, Pora na czarownicę. I watched it based on a true story of a priest who started a place for people who had AIDS. If you haven't watched the movie, it's very interesting, very nice movie to watch. But anyway, there's a conversation between the priest, Linda, played him, and another priest who said, well, how is it that people love you and they don't like me? And he says, well, because I'm very good at preaching. I had five, the highest grade in preaching. I had five too. They made a mistake, probably. Very interesting conversation. And then he says that he's just following his conscience. People are against, some people are for, some people are against. But when I know that I'm doing the right thing, ultimately, people will accept me. Very inspiring thing, definitely. Another source of inspiration, if you don't know him, you should. We owe him a lot, a lot. We owe him the Polish Pope and also probably getting rid of communism here. Very inspiring person. Remember the Dropkin joke. The reputation is very easy to lose, but very hard to gain. So in terms of ethics, remember that if you lose your reputation as an ethical person, it's going to be very hard to regain. So again, watch out that you don't get there. That's for those of you who speak Polish. There is a very old verse that I remember that again as a child, essentially telling you that that honor is one thing that if we don't take care of it, if we get a spot on it, dirty spot, then it's very difficult to wash. Braveheart, where of course a lot of fantasy in that movie because we don't know much about the real Braveheart, but in Gibson's movie, he says, all people die, some never live. That's the last slide, and I try to finish on time. I would say, always react to dishonesty, wherever you see it, whether your reaction is hard or just looking at the person. Remember last week I told you that around some women you don't use bad words. How does it happen? I guess those women are just, whenever that happens for the first time, they look at you in such a way that you never feel like using a bad word in their neighborhood. Be like that. It's so simple. Whenever you see dishonesty, react to it. Even if it's just, if it's your superior, you are afraid of saying, don't do that, look at that person. Without smiling. They will know what you mean here. Avoid weak people, because they are the ones who can betray you when time comes. It's a hard problem how to recognize weak people, but that comes with age. People who are suspecting others of something are usually guilty of it themselves. So they are saying, oh, you know, people are so dishonest, they are stealing things. First thing I think is, I wonder what you do. Right? So people very often use that kind of justification, everybody does it. And very often they have problems with the ethics of themselves. That's a warning sign to me. People who are assuring that they are honest, like, you know, coming to you, I'm a really honest person, really, you know. That's a warning sign also, because honest people don't need to tell they are honest. They are just doing it with their behavior. A person who is dishonest in one thing is typically a scoundrel, dishonest person in other things. Your colleagues in the university who are cheating, who are, you know, copying the exams and copying projects, when you look at them now, or look at them 10 years from now, you will see that they did bigger things when they graduated. It's a slope, they're going down. Okay, very good, that's the end. At the end of my time also, I'd like to thank you very much. As far as your grades, it's a Zal or not Zal. Those of you who had two or fewer absences, you can count on Zal without any questions. Those of you who have more absences than two, I will contact you individually and propose a meeting to make up for to talk about the situation, why you were absent, and make up something. So you can rest assured that if you don't hear from me, you have a passing grade. Okay. Thank you very much.